The Safari Park.
You're killing me, Larry.
Hello, Larry.
Hands off to Larry.
Larry. Fucking Larry.
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 Larry. Larry, get into bed now.
Is there no sweeter sound than that of your own name, buried in cheers and applause? I think not. Well, here we are on episode 44. How about that? Just a few days shy of my favorite season, autumn. Which always makes me wonder why the hell I live in Southern California, where seasons are as uniform as Hollywood nose jobs. This is when I really miss the Northeast, when your eyes are assaulted by color riots on the trees and your nose gets those first whiffs of burning firewood and pointy chicks demonstrate how they can distort woolen sweaters. When I was a kid, people used to burn the leaves they raked out of their yards, and that was one of the most glorious fragrances that could ever fill your head. I had an uncle back then with a fair-sized spread in Connecticut. Lots of trees on the property, and when they'd let go of their leaves, you'd be waist-deep in them. My brother and I would help him rake the property, which was several acres. We'd fill empty refrigerator and washing machine crates with leaves, and then we'd shove them in the back of a rusty old Ford wagon he had and run them down to a thingamajig he'd slap together every fall. It was four sides of cyclone fencing, maybe 10 feet high and about a dozen feet per side. It held a hell of a lot of leaves. We'd dump in box after box as the day wore on, as formations of Canadian geese would fly over, honking their heads off. Finally, around dusk, it was time for the best part of the ritual, torching those dry leaves. One year he added a cinematic flourish and sprinkled a couple of gallons of gas atop those leaves. Then he wrapped a rag around one end of a length of pipe and sparked that. We all backed off a good ways as he heaved that flaming javelin into the leaf pile, and instantaneous primordial massive bonfire, a multi-sensory show. The heat of that fire would redden your cheeks. The crackling was exciting and unpredictable. You could taste and smell the smoke that distillers try to capture in aged whiskies, and the look of it, oh. Flames shooting high into the dusky evening sky, a plume of smoke and the living, writhing show that only a big crackling fire can put on. Nothing can substitute. We must all be part moth, because we just cannot stay away or look away from a fire, can we? We just stand and stare like it was the greatest show on earth, and damned if it wasn't, because any fire, campfire, bonfire, or several cubic yards of burning leaves and brush just somehow throws a switch in our brains. What switch? It's the on switch of our imaginations. We can gaze into those flames and see anything we want. And somehow, maybe, because open flames in the night set off something from our beginnings in the caves, we just feel more alive when we're near fire. I got my first kiss in front of a raging bonfire on a beach in southern New Jersey. I was just 12 or 13. It wouldn't have happened if she and I were watching television or a football game. There's just something about those flames that trigger things. The parallels between fire and romance are too many to catalog, and writers and artists have been articulating those for millennia, which is really where this episode is going. But before we take that turn, I want to linger a bit longer on the doorstep of autumnal bliss. When I was a really small kid, the most hated day of the week after Monday, which meant the torment and tedium of school, was Sunday, which was a hideous preface to the misery of Monday. Sunday started off pretty good. Mom would usually make a kick-ass breakfast, fried eggs and bacon and pancakes and so on. But from there, the day went right in the toilet. Next, It was time to suit up in fancy pants and shiny shoes and haul ass down to church for an interminable torture session on ass-punishing benches surrounded by wrinkles with rosaries, liver-spotted sausage-fingered hands, bad breath, blue hair, and orthopedic shoes. The torture would violate the Geneva Convention if one particular priest was in the house. I like to call him the hypnotist. Guy could put a method to sleep. He sounded a little like Batman's Bane, only even more monotone. No matter what he said, this is what I heard. Then it was back home, where Mom and Dad would relax with the Sunday papers. I could not yet read, and this drove me nuts. My older brother would read the comics, but I had no interest in them because they were all shit. Not one of them was remotely funny, especially Peanuts. Ooh, I hated Charlie Brown and all his friends. Bunch of neurotic losers. It was a pleasure to assist in Charlie Brown's suicide, which formed the centerpiece of the very first episode of this show last December. Check it out. But I digress. One torturous autumn Sunday, I looked at the newspaper magazine my mom held, and there was a drawing, simple yet intriguing. And that drawing was of a grizzled old pipe-smoking man sitting on a log, and a little boy, just about my own age, nearby. Together, they looked across a country field at dusk. And out in that field, which was backed by a gorgeous orange sunset, were some strange goings-on. There were corn husks and smoke and teepees and wisps of Indian ghosts dancing around a fire, and I wanted to know what was written about that picture. And so my mom read it to me, and this is what the old man on the log said to that little kid.
Yep, sonny, it sure enough is Injun summer. Don't know what that is, I reckon, do you? Well, that's when all the homesick Injuns come back to play. You know, long time ago, long before your granddaddy was born even, there used to be heaps of Injuns around here, thousands, millions. They was all around here, right here where you're standing. But don't be scared. Ain't none around here now. Leastways, no live ones. But every year, long about now, they all come back. Leastways, their spirits do. They're here now. You can see them off across the fields. Look real hard. Look. See that? See that kind of hazy mist look out yonder? Well, them's Injuns. Injun spirits marching and dancing in the sunlight. That's what makes that kind of haze. It's everywhere. It's just the spirits of the Injuns all come back. They're all around us now. See off yonder? See them teepees? They kind of look like corn shocks from here, but them's Injun tents. Smell that smoky sort of smell in the air? That's their campfires a-burning and their pipes a-going. Lots of people say it's just leaves burning, but it ain't. It's campfires, and the Injuns are hopping around them to beat the old harrier. You just come out here tonight when the moon is hanging over the hill off yonder and the harvest fields is all swimming in the moonlight and you can see the Injuns and the teepees just as plain as can be. Did you ever notice how the leaves turn red about this time of year? That's just another sign of redskins. That's when an old Injun spirit gets tired dancing and goes up and squats on a leaf to rest. Why? I can hear him rustling and whispering and creeping round among the leaves all the time. And every once in a while a leaf gives way under some fat old Injun ghost and comes floating down to the ground. See, look, there's one now. See how red it is? That's the war paint rubbing off an Injun ghost. Sure as you're born. Pretty soon, all Injuns go marching away again, back to the happy hunting ground. But next year, you'll see them trooping back. The sky just hazy with them, and their campfires smoldering away, just like they are now.
That story and that drawing were made in 1907 and reprinted many times since then. It's been declared politically incorrect by some assholes. As revealed in episode 12, my DNA says I am part Native American. I prefer to say Indian. And I don't find so much as a single syllable of that story offensive. If somebody does, that's their problem, isn't it? So I mentioned earlier the endless similarities between romance and fire, and thought this might be a good time to segue into what happens when romantic fires go out, but only for one party, as seems to be the case with Dan, a listener and a Patreonie. Dan is struggling with a situation most of us have faced at one time or another, healing a busted heart. Before I get into Dan's dilemma, I want to throw a big, big thank you at Dan for not only supporting this show, but for his guts and generous spirit in requesting that I share his story with all of you in hopes that you may benefit from it as well. Man, our dojo members are BPOE. That's best people on earth. Here's what Dan has to say. Hi, Larry. Loved your appearances on the Dick Show and followed you over to your show. I'm looking for some advice about romance. Not helping finding love, but giving up on love because it's killing me and starting to affect my actions. I'm a student at an arrogant university. I study engineering that has a small and close-knit department, and about a year ago I started dating one of my classmates and things were going great. I'd never had a successful relationship before, and we were very happy together. However, time passed, and her behavior changed. After 4 to 5 months, her demeanor changed. She stopped responding to messages or texts when she used to immediately. Anytime I asked her to hang out or go on a date, she was, quote, busy, unquote. She seemed to avoid me in class. After a couple of months of this, she called me over to her place and broke up with me mere days before graduation. I was shocked. I could not figure out what went wrong. She never really told me what the issues were other than, quote, the spark was gone and she just wanted a break, unquote. Despite not understanding our breakup, I accepted that it happened. Over the summer, we went our separate ways and I slowly stopped caring about our failed relationship. Fast forward to now, we've both returned to the same graduate school. She's completely moved on from our relationship, and I thought I had too, but I now see that isn't the case. Seeing her in class dredges up nostalgia and yearning. Hearing her talk, joke, and laugh triggers intense feelings in me I'd hoped had gone dormant. She's in most of my classes, so it just isn't possible to ignore her. To make matters worse, she has begun behaving in a way with our other friends and classmates that she used to behave with me. Watching her with that flirty, fun tone and behavior with other men is painful and sours my mood. While my feelings for her have tempered since we broke up, I think I am still very much in love with her, given how I feel when she's around. I avoid going out with mutual friends and classmates in fear that she will be there. This cannot be good for my mental or social health. There's no chance of us getting back together, but she's stuck in my life until she finishes her degree in the spring. How do I get over her and get my life back together and not spiral into a depressive slump? In other words, how can I force my heart to take no shit and man up? Thanks, Larry. I'll see you at the crossroads. Wow. Well, Dan, you need no manning up, because merely writing that email took some pretty big balls. What you do need is some seasoning, some attitude adjustment, and something we try to deliver here at the dojo, enlightenment. Let me start off with some first aid. You are stuck in a shitty place, having to see this chick day in and day out, having mutual friends. What you are experiencing is a divorce dress rehearsal. Though I've never had the misery of that experience, I've plenty of pals who have, and after the alimony, this is what they find most difficult. After two lives intersect for a time, they soon intertwine. And that's when it gets really messy because shared friends have to choose sides. It's colossally fucked up. Although in pain right now, at least yours has an end date. Pity the millions who never really can fully split, and the most helpless victims of love gone wrong, children. Marriage without kids is just dating with a contract. So take some solace in the fact that this experience is as temporary as a sunburn. In time, the sting will subside, and moving forward, you'll be more careful. There's a lot of insight to be gleaned from the fact that she is your first love. And when first loves go wrong, of course they hurt the most because we lack the experience to process the emotional hit. Anyone who's ever taken a solid punch to the face never forgets the first one, and anyone who never has is truly unready for combat, because getting slugged is an unavoidable part of the game. I'm betting you were not her first serious boyfriend. Although, after only 4 to 5 months, I'm not sure that even qualifies as serious. That's barely enough time to get to know someone, especially a female someone, because they are all crafty, sneaky, and adept at deception and emotional manipulation. Chicks are better equipped than men for romantic trauma. More broken-hearted guys manage to kill themselves, while women are far better at attempts. Chicks usually take 5 Advils, call it a suicide attempt, and revel in attention for a few weeks. Men wind up at the morgue and forgotten. So there. Now for that first aid. You're stuck with her in classes, but when you are, you have got to make a conscious effort not to look at her. Try to be sure she's sitting somewhere behind you so she's not in your field of view. When she speaks, try to tune her out. Time your entrances and exits from those classrooms so you are as far from her as possible. Next, you need what is called a starter kit. Somewhere in that school is another girl, or maybe she's a waitress at a local restaurant or works at a store, but somewhere in your orbit is a girl you have looked at more than once. Maybe she doesn't make your thing swing like the ex, but she has something. A great smile, or perfect ankles, or a neck that must be bitten, or an ass you could crack eggs on, but something you find attractive. She is your starter kit. Ask her out to coffee, or lunch, or a walk in the park, something 90 minutes or less. Just try to get to know her a little and see if she's at least a distraction for you. If it goes well and she's willing, take her to dinner or hiking or miniature golf, anything but a movie. Movies! Never take a chick to a movie early in a relationship. It's completely counterproductive to everything. Also, under no circumstances should you even mention your ex-girlfriend to her. So many people on the rebound do that, and it is a pure asshole move, selfish, boring, and a buzz killer. A fresh date should be a clean slate, all excitement and anticipation. Nobody wants to play therapist to a new boyfriend. You're still in school, where monogamy is just stupid. In fact, anyone, especially any male anyone, who marries before age 30 is taking a big chance. Remember, guys are hardwired for polygamy. You have got to tap into that genetic uncoding. Do it. And realize that at your age, dating is a buffet, and if you stall at the salad bar, you're going to regret it and wind up with nothing but spinach between your teeth. So surf the web for images of the hottest, pointiest babes on the planet and download their pictures to your phone, or maybe just shoot one of that cute barista you took to lunch. Every time you hear ex-girlfriend's sexy voice in your class, sneak a look at one on that phone and realize that you should be sampling as much of the worldwide babe buffet as possible without dying of dehydration. Like my grandpa used to tell me, when you're 18, you can always find something wrong with a girl. By the time you're 38, you can always find something right. So the moment you get involved, and by involved I mean just casual dating. The moment you get involved with some starter kit chick, you will start to feel better and less bothered by your ex and her jokes and laughs and flirty game with other dudes. Now, for the enlightenment portion of the prescription, Dan, nobody likes rejection or rejecting another, and your ex-girlfriend had already left you the very first time she didn't return your text or decided to be busy. But you, being new to the game, failed to interpret her very clear and classic femme signals. You did not get the hint. And so she had to have a formal sit-down and break up with you to wise you up. Next time you get involved with a girl, give her one I'm busy free pass. And if it happens twice, you get busy. Forever. To endure multiple I'm busies is to take shit. And we don't take shit at this dojo. It erodes your confidence and manhood. In fact, some chicks get their rocks off rejecting guys who keep coming back for more rejection. Don't go down that path, ever. It's a sucker's walk. Now, not being an eyewitness, I cannot say whether your ex derives any pleasure from watching you pine for her charms. So here's an idea you might want to try. Let's say that hot little barista down at the local coffee joint, not Starbucks, we fucking hate Starbucks and all it stands for. Say you and she go out a few times and hit it off. Why not invite her to lunch and see if she can meet you right outside of class, where your ex-girlfriend will see her greet you, grab you, maybe put a full-body lip lock on you. This will achieve many goals. One, it will provide closure and help exercise your romantic demons. Two, it will pump up your own confidence. And don't be surprised, Dan, if subsequently your ex corners you for a little chat. If so, keep it brief. No more than 2 minutes, and I mean 120 seconds max. And when you take leave of her company, be sure to tell her you have to go because Lola or Fiona or whatever your new friend's name is waiting. And should this event transpire, do not, for a nanosecond, consider getting back together with the ex. She is over in the past, and that is where she must remain. Dan, it's always nice to have someone in your life, but it need not be the someone. This is a construct sold to us by Madison Avenue, that life is somehow less worth living without the love of your life beside you for every adventure. Clearly, your ex was not the one for you. Imagine for a moment if she discovered she'd lost that spark 2 or 3 years or 2 or 3 children into the relationship. Your life would be irrevocably fucked, as millions who have that experience would attest. So rejoice, you survived this romantic scuffle with a mere nick on your heart and a bruise on your ego. It's autumn, man, and great stuff is right around the corner, like Halloween parties where pointy chicks will trigger cultural appropriation fucktards with sexually suggestive costumes of Pocahontas and geishas and so on. And every one of those chicks wears those things so guys like you have a ready-made excuse to walk up to them and tell them you love their outfit. Hey, thanks for hanging with me once again. It's always great to be with you. Slide over to my homepage at thatlarryshow.com where I've posted the original drawing of the Injun Summer for your autumnal viewing pleasure. I shot the picture of the cornfield at twilight for this episode's thumbnail, not far from where my uncle torched that cage full of leaves many moons ago. I hope you like it. If you've downloaded this show from iTunes, why not take a few extra seconds and give it a 5-star review? It really helps the show grow. And if you really like what you just heard, why not do what Dan the Man did and join the dojo? Just click that Patreon button. There you will find special rewards like signed books, bonus episodes only you can hear, and a deep bench of senseis ready to help you kick life's ass. Drop us an email with whatever's bugging you at thatlarryshow@gmail.com. We'll try to help you out. And so, my friends, as you first notice the scent of burning logs or the geese honking their way to warmer climes, close your eyes and see that beautiful Injun summer twilight. And know this. From the ashes of autumn leaves may rise the blooms of your best tomorrows. We can be a parable or a phoenix. The choice is ours to make. Hey, it's getting a little chilly out here with the Injun spirits. I think I'll go back inside and sit by the fire with some distilled spirits. I'll see you next Tuesday, right here at the crossroads of madness and enlightenment. And until that time, take no shit.